everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today we're going to actually be talking to a man in the UK. His name is David Grubel, and we're going to be talking about education and what's kind of going on in his mind with education, seeing how he's been in it for a very long time. So, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be on it.
You're very welcome. Now, David, let's talk a little bit about who David is first. Kind of give us a little background and why you got into the education field to begin with.
Right. Well, my own education was very traditional. I went to Eton, the expensive and exclusive school, where there was corporal punishment. We were beaten with sticks if we did things wrong. And after I left school, for a short time I worked in the office of a small chain of tobacco shops that belonged to my father, and I didn't enjoy it. I wasn't interested. And it suddenly occurred to me that I preferred working with children to working with adults. And so I got back into the academic world and got a degree and became a teacher. And the first school I taught in was another exclusive boys' private school for boys from 13 to 18. And very formal, and again, there was corporal punishment for particular crimes, such as misbehavior in class. And I was there for 3 years, and during that time, I found a whole lot of things that I thought was wrong with the way that children were treated there. And in the end, I just left. I gave my notice, and at the end of the term, I left, without having found anywhere else to go. And by a great stroke of luck, and it was just completely luck, I was in a bookshop waiting for somebody, browsing in books, picking up a book here and there and looking at it, and I found a book about Dartington Hall, an experiment in South Devon, which included a school and was about 60 pages about the school. And I read those 60 pages as I stood there waiting, and it seemed to have solutions to all my problems. And so I wrote and asked whether there was a job. And when I first wrote, there wasn't a job, but by an extraordinary stroke of luck again, the German teacher had to leave at the end of the term, and they had only a very short time to appoint anybody else. And so they called me down for interview, and I started work there as the German teacher. And being there was just a fantastic relief. I didn't have to act anymore. I didn't have to throw my weight around. I didn't have to order people about. I was able just to be myself, which hadn't been possible at the schools I was in previously. In the previous schools, I had to act a role the whole time. I had to pretend to be a tough guy, which I was not at all good at pretending to be. This place, I could just be myself, and it was a most wonderful change.
The school system needs to change as the children change. And like here in the United States, they keep the same old going on year after year after year after year, which is very boring for these children of today because they appear to be so much more intelligent. And even though they say that they're not focusing, which I really do not believe is true, I believe that they're just multitasking, then all of a sudden they want to put them on all this medicine because, hey, they can't focus, they're not paying attention and stuff like that. Is there, well, actually anywhere in the world, is there a better way, in your opinion, to get the children to be more engaged in school and actually be happy with school rather than unhappy?
Well, I mean, the straightforward answer is, of course, yes, there is. And the extreme version of this is just making lessons voluntary so that you don't have to go to lessons if you don't want to. Or even, as in Sudbury Valley School in Massachusetts, where there are no lessons at all. There aren't any lessons to choose not to go to. At the schools I've taught in, there have always been lessons. But there's been freedom for children to go if they want to. And it makes a tremendous difference to the whole atmosphere in the classroom. And people come because they're interested and they want to learn. And it's completely different to a school where they come because they're made to go. And when I was at school myself, and actually at university, one of the things I didn't like ever was a book that we were, anything that we were forced to do. If it was a book that we had to read, I didn't like it automatically. I didn't like it as much as other books by the same author. It was only when I was able to choose, and university was a fair amount of choice, of course, I was able to discover books that I really wanted to read and really work at them. And at school, it was just drudgery.
I think it's real important, David, that people understand that today, because a lot of students, again, in my way of thinking, are very, very much advanced. And for them to be put into a system where they're still reading the same old books and they're told that they have to read them, and they're very boring books, when there are so many other great books out there that, you know, can be done, but yet the school system won't accept it. So I tend to agree with you. I think if children have fun, number one, coming to school, they would rather come to school than stay home and do nothing at that point. But if they're not going to have fun and they're going to be made to sit for 45, 50, 55 minutes at a time, listen to the same old humdrum, monotone-type teacher, or some class that's very boring, they're not going to enjoy it. So if children, you know, here in the United States, they're not really given that chance where you have a choice, you can go or you can't go. I mean, they're almost forced to go, and if you don't, then your parents can get in trouble and all that kind of stuff. So if there were a school where children actually would come and enjoy coming, and we put them all around the world, don't you think that would be much better than the systems that we have now?
Absolutely, completely. Yes, much, much better. And I've seen it in different countries, many, many different countries, and with many different kinds of children. And I've seen in Delhi, there's an organization, Delhi, India, New Delhi, there's a school called Butterflies, but it's not a school, they're street educators. And they're people who go out onto the streets with trunks full of slates and chalk and fairly old-fashioned books, perhaps. And any of the street children who want to come to learn principally arithmetic and English to start with, they come because they want to, and they do come, even though it means they lose earning time. And when they're working full-time, they only get just enough to survive on. But that's children who choose to come because they want to learn.
See, I think there are more children that would actually choose to come if the school systems were changed so that they actually get to enjoy themselves. Like, you know, I had sent you an email, and we used some of your quotes on my schoolofnow.org website, and we're going to quote one of those in just a little bit. But that's how I originally got in touch with you, because my thing was to open a school that children would actually want to come to, be happy at, and enjoy learning. And I can't see it happening with today's education the way it's taught. So in the school of now, the classes are actually taught at 20, 25-minute increments for the children who can pick up real quick, and then there's a break, and then they'll come back and they'll study some more. You know, and it's very much hands-on, which I think also helps children to learn better than giving them a book and say, okay, you have to read this and report tomorrow. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would, yes. Another school that I've been terribly impressed by is a place called the Bildungsschule in Germany. I've been impressed by what the person running the school has done and said. I haven't actually been there myself. But he says he worked in an ordinary government primary school with children from 6 to 11. For 4 years, he took the group right through for 4 years, and he didn't do any conventional teaching at all. And what he says is that children come to school in Germany at the age of 6. They come to school, and they are expecting to do all sorts of exciting and interesting things. They're all keen and ready to go. And then they're given dull stuff to do, and within a few weeks, they're bored and they're totally fed up. And so he was faced with that problem, and also with, in an ordinary government school, he had children who didn't have English as their first language, children who very, very intelligent and advanced, children who were very much behind, children with all sorts of different problems, in a group of only 24, and he thought there was nothing he could give them to do that would suit them all. So he didn't give them anything to do. They chose for themselves right from the beginning. They had a meeting each day in the morning, and they decided, they discussed what they were going to do, or each child discussed separately what they were going to do. And they liked school better than not being in school. They came to school because they wanted to be there, because they were able to do things that they actually wanted to do.
Yeah, I think a lot of times the systems are really stopping the children from actually learning, because if they're
too
smart,
I quite agree, yes.
It doesn't work. If they're too low, it doesn't work, and they want them to fit right in that little bell curve. And the problem is that every single child, in my opinion, learns differently, and every single child is going to accept something better than one of the others. But in the long run, if they can have fun, like play games with them that are teaching them, they're going to learn really well. And so, again, one of the things in the School of Now is that we're going to have fun, you know, and not that we're going to, you know, not have any kind of rules or anything, because we will, but they're going to come and have fun. And the teachers that are going to be there are going to have to actually want to sit down on the floor and play with these children and want to have fun with them, or they won't be able to work at the School of Now. And everybody looks at me and goes, "Oh, you can't do that." And it's like, "Oh, yes, I can." You know, because to me, the education system is all messed up, and it's the same old, same old. You know, and I don't have an education background, but it does not take a certified teacher to look at the results of all these children not wanting to go to school, children not graduating, and having all of these low, they say, IQs, when in reality, when they're tested, their IQs are like, you know, in the 150, 160 range, and they go, "Well, I don't understand that." You know, so there has to be some different way to get the normal, everyday educational system to understand that it's time for a change.
Respect for children, in my opinion. And, well, I've seen so many cases and heard of so many cases where places have been set up where children who have been treated as stupid at school have gone to some new place where they've not been treated as stupid and have very soon demonstrated that indeed they're not, and that it is actually treating children as if they're stupid that makes them stupid. There's a Swiss teacher I very much admire called Yogi Agar, who wrote a book called Dummheit ist lernbar, which means stupidity is learnable. And in that he gives many, many examples of children he has taught in his special classes who had been made stupid by being told they were stupid, and made liars by being told they told lies, and been made thieves by being told they were dishonest. Absolutely extraordinary that if you're treated as if you were something, well, then you tend to become it. So if you're treated as lazy and ignorant, then that's how you react.
Mm-hmm. One of the quotes, one of the quotes that I used of yours, I think is a really good quote. It says, "Everything these children have been told is wrong with them is actually what's right with them. They are hope and they are our future." That is a very strong, strong statement. And can you explain why, you know, there's a statement like that?
Partly this Swiss man who has given me this idea that, but I mean, if a child is told, he's told he's stupid, and he behaves in a stupid way, it doesn't mean that he's good to be stupid. And as soon as he is in a situation where he's treated with respect and people talk to him properly as an equal, where the teachers cooperate rather than telling people what to do, then he's likely to change. Well, I mean, I don't think he's likely to change. I think he's sure to change. I've heard so many examples of that sort of thing happening. So it's a place, a mining village. So that was people with very poor backgrounds on the whole. And the school leaving age was raised in Great Britain from 15 to 16. And there were a whole lot of 15-year-olds who were appalled at this, because they thought, "Oh, thank God, now I'm 15, I'm going to go out and get a job. and they were told they couldn't go out and get a job. They had to spend another year in school. And there was an experimental group set up for just 15 boys from a particular school who were thought of as the least ones least likely to get anything from an extra year in school. And these boys were convinced that they were useless. One of the teachers who was with them, with the group, wrote about his first impression of them. Well, no, it's actually his impression of them for some weeks. Was that they were sure that they were useless. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't put tools away in a cupboard. They couldn't do the washing up. When someone said that you haven't done it properly, they said, that's all I can do. That's me. That's what I am. And they were encouraged to find things that they wanted to do. And the first thing they wanted to do actually was earn some money. So they did find various ways of earning a little. But the business of being treated as people who could decide on their own lives made an absolutely fantastic difference to them. And after they'd been in the place just for 1 year, they only had to stay for 1 year, and then they were able to leave school. All 15 of them have apparently led successful lives or contented lives, and two of the 15 are said to have become millionaires. And that's the children who were thought of as being the most useless in the school, the children who could do nothing. And mm-hmm. two of them went in and did that.
You know, and I think children themselves truly want to learn. And I do believe that everybody learns differently. You know, the schools here, David, finally, after years and years of knowing it, admitted that boys learn differently than girls. But yet, for years and years, they tried to push them all the same direction. So now that they've made the statement that boys learn differently than girls, there's not been a lot of different things that they've tried, as far as I can see from what I've been told. But, you know, knowing that that was going on for a long, long time, and just now, a couple years ago, saying it, to me, that in itself makes it not a good situation for children, because it is basically admitting that the school system hasn't done its job.
Yes.
You know, so I listen to what's going on, and I've talked to many teachers, and the ones that are retiring early, the ones who are only there to get paid because they can't really teach at this point, like here in the United States, from what I understand, there's a lot and lot of paperwork that the teacher has to do on every single child after school is over. So the teachers, they're tired. So when they come back to teach the next day, it's like, okay, let's just get through with the curriculum that we have to manage. They're not encouraging the children to be individuals. They're not encouraging them to be who they need to be, not at all. And to me, it's like, why would you want to keep going to a school like that?
Yes, exactly, yes. Why do they want to go to a school like that? Another place that is totally extraordinary by conventional standards is Tokyo Shura in Tokyo, surprise, which was set up for children who refused to go to school, because there are an awful lot of school refusers in Japan because the system is so very authoritarian and demands such very precise types of behavior. And so lots of children don't want to go to school, and there are frequent suicides as well, even in the country. So this place was set up for school refusers, and it's the only school I know of where if you're enrolled in that school, you don't have to go. You only go when you feel like it. And so these children who've been refusing to go to school for a long time, at first, hardly go at all. They may go once in a week for an hour or so. Then they see what's going on there and all the different things they can do. They begin to stay for longer. And lots of them eventually actually even go back into the ordinary educational system once they've established their own personalities. They feel able to face a much more rigid situation, and they're able to cope with it.
Don't you think it would be nice, David, if instead of testing the children to see at what intelligence level they are, testing them to see what kind of personalities they have and what they're most likely interested in. So then classes can be designed around that, almost as an individual type setting. But do you think that would work much better than the typical strict school system that we now have?
Yeah, I think it would work better. But I think what's best of all is actually just talking to children and helping them to find the things that they really want to do, so that the teacher doesn't have to set any, but isn't obliged to convey information, only to offer help and advice. And children who have the opportunity to choose for themselves do choose well. I don't know very many schools where this actually happens, but I mean, in all the schools I've been to all around the world, there have been, there are a number that have impressed me very, very much for that reason, that the children are able to choose their own route through the school.
Again, I think if they are able to choose, they would be a little bit more interested. Like, I've made the statement to people that if a child likes working on cars, for example, whether it's a boy or a girl, in order to really work on a car, they have to know math, science, and English. And people look at me like, what? It's like, yeah, just think about this. To work on a car, you have to have those three subjects in mind. So why not teach according to hands-on? If they learn better working with something, which most children do, then why not make it a hands-on learning process where they can learn different things like math, science, and English? Or if they're going to be doing carpentry or stuff that they really are attracted to, teach the normal subjects through whatever subject they are choosing that they like the most. I mean, to me, it would work out much, much better than, again, the typical school situation. But it's very hard to get people to change their mind because they're so dead set. This is the way it's been taught forever. This is the way. And it's like, well, forget forever, because these children are bored with it and they're not going to do it.
Yes. And if you're forced to learn something, then it's very hard work. And if you're not forced to learn it, but you're just doing it because you're interested, then it's very, very easy. When I was first working, I said it was a tobacconist that my father had, but it was also a wine shop, and he wanted me to learn the names of the wines and where they all came from, and I wasn't interested. And I just couldn't learn them. It wasn't that I didn't try. I tried to learn them, but I just couldn't, because it didn't mean anything to me. And at the same time, it was the beginning when traditional jazz was first being heard in the UK. It hadn't been heard there before. And I knew the names of everybody on any record that I had. I knew who was playing clarinet and who was playing drums. And I never learned it. I just knew because I read it once and I remembered it.
Mm-hmm. You know, on your website, and the website is www.david. And it's G like George, G like George, RIBBLE .co.uk. Did I get that backwards? I got it backwards.
That's right, yes.
Okay, so it's www.davidgruber.co.uk. If people go on that website, you know, they are going to get a lot of really, really good information from the website. So browse around because it's really a good one. But on one of yours, you have, again, these quotes or statements that you make. And one is that I really find very, very interesting. It says, teaching is not a matter of making children learn. It is a matter of making sure you don't get in their way. And then
yes. You
put an answer, teachers know more about their subjects than children do. Children know more about childhood. You know,
yes. Those
are very important statements. So when you make a statement like that, David, maybe explain a little bit about that particular statement.
Which one?
The teacher is not a matter of making children learn. It's the matter of making sure you don't get in their way. That's important.
Yes, exactly. Yes, what children want to learn, as you were saying earlier on, children want to learn. And one of the ways of stopping them learning is saying, no, you can't do that. What you must do is come here and watch this scientific experiment I'm doing. And A.S. Deal said at one time about children playing in a stream and building dams, and a teacher coming up and saying, oh, this is very interesting, isn't it, children? Now, let's see if we can work out why the water behaves in this particular way. And the children got bored and walked away immediately. And if he'd left them to go on playing in the mud, what he thought I was playing, they would have learned a tremendous lot about the behavior and water and all sorts of different things. And he stopped them from doing it by turning it into a school subject.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think children have, again, a great deal of knowledge that are just waiting to be able to say what they know. And, you know, by always talking and not listening to what the children's trying to say, you're doing a very big injustice to them and to yourself, too, because they're actually here to teach us a lot of stuff, too, and we're the adults and don't want to listen, but it's time to listen, don't you think?
There are times to listen, yes. Oh, I don't want time for the adults to listen, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very extraordinary that adults on the whole don't listen to children. I mean, it seems to be most amazing that people are able to misunderstand children to such a huge extent.
On your website, David, you also have what you call democratic education. Can you explain that?
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, sorry, right. Yeah. Democratic education is the word that seems to be used. It's used by this great big group of international democratic education conferences, which happen every year in a different country. And they're called democratic, but to my mind, it isn't the democratic aspect itself that's the most important thing. I mean, democratic is, some people think the important thing is that there should be school meetings where the children and staff together make all the decisions. And I think that's a nice idea, but I don't think it's essential. What is essential is that the staff and the children should be equals. They should work together. They should cooperate. And that's what I think democratic education is about. The number of schools in the International Democratic Education Network, there's a very wide variety of schools that have different approaches. But for me, as long as they listen to children and treat them with respect, they count as democratic, whether they have a timetable or not, whether they have rules or not, all those different things don't matter. What matters is just the relationship.
See, and I think it's real important that there is a democratic type, you know, way of helping the students actually voice their opinion and give a vote into what's being done. And, you know, I don't really think that six-year-olds are too young to give an opinion. Although they may give a fairy tale opinion, it's still an opinion. And by the time you reach your teenage years, if your opinions haven't been heard, all of a sudden you're shut down and you don't want to say anything. You don't want to talk. Mm-hmm. You don't want anybody asking you questions. You don't want to be bothered. You know, and I see a lot of that going on right now. You know, and the other thing I see is that a lot of people are very much opposed to children with video games, but there are many video games out there that actually teach the children different subjects, and I don't think parents are paying attention to that. They're just concerned that they're on the computer too long, which I'm not all thrilled with computers anyway because they don't like me and I don't like them, but there are some very good, you know, teaching videos out there that can be played on a computer, even in the classroom, that children can get in and enjoy. You know, a lot of music, children like music. They like to do things with rhythm, move around, dance around, and they learn. You know, so how do you feel about the video being used in classrooms?
I don't terribly like it being used as a something for the whole class to do. And video games, of course, it's not usually the whole class. I think as long as they're permitted, on the whole, if there's a good environment in the school, then after a bit, children will get weaned from them. They won't want particularly want them. There'll be more interesting things to do. Other people are more fun than most computer games. And you can play computer games when you go home in the evening and there isn't anybody else around. When you're at school, it's fun to be with the other people and playing games and talking and doing things together. When I was at Tamariki in New Zealand, it was when computers were still fairly new, and they had put a computer in one computer in each class, just one, and the children were around it all the time. Each computer was surrounded by children who were totally concentrated on it, and the staff got more and more upset and said, "What are we to do? Must we forbid this? Because obviously it's not going to be a good thing." And then after a few weeks, it just stopped. And when I was there, I think the computers weren't even used. They were just sitting there. Nobody did anything with them. I think other people are more fun than machines.
Most of the time, that's true. Put the phone just away from your mouth a little bit more because it's starting to echo again. The other thing, David, I think is real important for people to understand how unhappy the children are at school these days, because they just appear to be unhappy. Do you find that to be somewhat true?
Yes, I think that most children are unhappy in school, and that's one of the things that is often remarked on by people from the schools that I've liked, go out into the world and they meet. They're very surprised to find how most of the adults they meet hated their time at school. They were very unhappy and they were frightened and they had a thoroughly bad time, whereas the people who'd been at these schools where they were allowed choices and allowed a great deal of freedom loved their schools and learned well.
What do you think about all the bullying that's going on in schools today? They bully the person at school, they bully them on the internet, they bully them by texting them, they bully them by emails. What do you think is causing that, David?
Well, my guess is that there are lots of different reasons for bullying. As a matter of fact, I saw a list of reasons for bullying made up by a primary school class whose teacher had asked them, why do they think people bully? And they had a whole string of reasons, because they'd been bullied, because they were unsure of themselves, because they wanted to establish themselves in some sort of way, because they were mistreated at home. I can't remember, there were strings and strings of reasons why people did do bullying. One of the things that I've heard many times in this country, this is in ordinary government schools too, is that if you want to stop bullying in the school, the way you do it is by discussing it with the children and setting up sort of a bullying committee or an anti-bullying group of children, not staff, and the children talk to the bullies and bring them together and bring the bullies and the victims together. And it gets sorted out amazingly effectively. One primary school in Britain I was at a circle time in the class where all the children were just sitting around, and the teacher was, in fact, in charge of the group, but only just. I think soon they were going to have a child as chair of the group. But there was one child who had refused to come to school because a boy in another group had been... He was frightened of a boy in another group. And so the teacher asked what should be done. And the children said, well, we must send for the boy and bring him here and tell him about it. So they sent off to the other class, and this bigger boy came. And they explained why he'd been sent for and how this younger boy was really frightened of him. And they said, well, what do you say to all that? And he said, I'm sorry. And then he and the boy who felt he was being bullied, went out of the classroom with a couple of other children and talked worked for a very short time and came back to the group with a bullet boy who'd been frightened, so happy and pleased. It was astonishing. I actually saw that happening, and I was very, very impressed by it.
Yeah, something really does need to be done here. All it does is it makes the TV news. And to me, all the media does is encourage the bullying going on because somebody's getting time on air. And I think, at least in this country, that if the media would not cover some of the things that they cover and make it look so, you know, fascinating or whatever, I think a lot of the bullying would also be cut down somewhat. Now, people have told me that's not true, Nancy, because they're going to be bullying anyway. You know, but here, the media hypes up everything to make it all look like Hollywood, da-da-da. And to me, it makes people do more of that same stuff just so that they can make the news, too. Would that be a possibility that you think might be going on?
I think it's probably, it's much more than just what's shown on television. I visited about 10 years ago or so the Puerto Rican high school in Chicago, where the people in the gangs it wasn't a question of bullying, it was a question of actually fighting with guns and killing each other. And it was mostly 12 and 13-year-olds who were doing the fighting, because the older people... the older people all knew each other. The leaders of the gangs knew each other and would meet and talk. But they, as it were, employed these younger boys, principally, to go out with guns and defend the streets that they were dealing drugs on. And a lot of them got killed. It was, made bullying seem a comparatively small thing. And... the Puerto Rican High School was established in part just to help people who wanted to get out of that. And they were having a hard time doing it because if you belong to a gang, you could make $300 a day quite easily, dealing in drugs. And if you went to school instead, if you went to high school, then you didn't make anything. And so they had to have a pretty high motivation to come there, and that place had a very, very pleasant atmosphere, in spite of having people in there who had been certainly gang members, and I think quite possibly had been involved in battles where people got killed. It was an astonishing place to be for me, coming from comparatively peaceful UK, to hear these stories, which were confirmed by members of staff. It wasn't only the pupils who told me these stories. They were, it was a world with completely different values that had somehow been imposed on these young people. And when they came to this, Dr. Albizu Campos, Puerto Rican High School, when they came there, they were able to behave as they felt, as they knew was a better way to behave, was the proper way to behave. And they were thankful to be there.
Now, you wrote a book. It's called Considering Children, A Parent's Guide to Progressive Education, because a lot of parents were talking, you know, about what is progressive education, you know, what is democratic education. So where would somebody go, David, if they want to get your books?
Considering Education is out of print, but it is, you can download it from my website. The other books... are available from a website, a different website. Shall I give it to you? It's www.libed, which is LIBED, .org.uk.
Okay, I'm going to have you repeat that again, okay?
Yeah, LibEd, it's short for Libertarian Education, LibEd, L-I-B-E-D, full stop, .org.uk.
So, David, give out your website again, please.
my own, is www.davidgribble.co.uk.
And again, on his website, there's many, many things. There is an article about Room 13 on your website.
Yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
I went to Room 13 because I read about it in the papers somewhere. It's an art studio in a primary school where the oldest children are just 12. It's an art studio where children can go in the first school I saw, where they could go, as soon as they'd finished their ordinary work, they could go up to the art studio and be there. They didn't actually have to do any art when they got there, but most of them did. They could listen to music or read or talk. I talked with the staff members quite often. And that place was run entirely by the children. So the school paid for the electricity and heating and light and gave them a room. And everything else was paid for by the children who used the group. So they bought their paints and they bought the brushes and they bought the canvas. And they even paid the artist in residence that they had working there, doing his own painting and helping them with their painting. And I went there, and I was there for a week and was completely fascinated by it because this was an ordinary government school in a not at all wealthy area. And there were these children doing the most staggeringly impressive art. And it's been exhibited at the Tate Modern in London, the top modern art museum, and people often can't believe that the work has been done by children. They believe it must be done by adults. And I was there for a week and was utterly bowled over by it and felt I hadn't understood it in a week. I mean, usually if you're in a place for a week, you get a fairly good idea about how it's working. But I had to go back for another week, a month later, to really get a feel for the place. And I thought it was very, very impressive indeed. And when I asked the children what they most valued about Room 13, I gave them a questionnaire based on the answers I'd had originally from casual conversations. So was it because they used professional quality paints, or was it because they could paint whatever they liked, or was it because they could chat with the teachers, or was it because they were running it for themselves? They had their own bank account. They had their own website. They own email address, and they dealt with their own correspondence. And whether that was one of the things they liked best. And the opinion, the absolutely overwhelming opinion, was that the most important thing for them was that they were doing something that was real. They weren't playing. They were actually doing real things. And that was what they valued most. And a tremendous lot of what you do in an ordinary school has no obvious value at all. I can remember when I was at school myself one day seeing a man delivering coal. And I thought, oh my God, if only I could get out and deliver coal instead of sitting here learning this stupid Latin and stuff. Activities that have a real clear purpose to children are something that is terribly important, I think.
You also have another article called The Lord of the Flies.
Oh, yes.
Explain that one a little bit, please.
Well, I love talking about this because so many people think The Lord of the Flies is a demonstration of the fact that if you give children freedom, they all become... become violent and fight each other. And in my opinion, well, there are two things about that. It can't be a demonstration of it because it's only fiction. So even if that was the message, then it wouldn't be a proof of any kind. But if you take it as a fable, then it gives actually the opposite message, because there are only four characters in the book who are in any way real. Should I explain the story briefly? Or do you think your listeners will know the story of the book?
A lot of children, I think, David, really, like you've stated through this entire interview, really want to learn. I think it's real important finding the best avenue for each child.
You're terribly quiet. I'm terribly quiet. I can't hear you very well.
I said we've been talking about how important it is for children with their education, but actually for them to choose what really interests them the most, because it really boils down to, if you can get their interest going and you can keep their interest going, they really will not have any choice except to learn. And it can be fun learning, not you do this, you do that. Do you think if worldwide a lot of the schools would take on this kind of a system where they allow the children to pick and choose, that the education worldwide would actually be better than it ever has been before?
Yes. It would make a great difference if there was something like that. In India, there is one whole state, Kerala, I think, where every single primary school has adapted to a method called activity-based learning, which is where children work independently mm-hmm. or in groups, and not doing exactly what the teacher says, standing in front of the class. And that's spread to, I think, something like 37,000 schools in this state. It's absolutely colossal. It's the biggest experiment I know of where children are actually being encouraged to find their own way of doing things, and who, to judge by what it says, really works. The children are happy and busy and want to be there and learn well.
Have you heard of this place in Italy called Dharmahar? Have you heard of that place?
What place?
Dharmahar. It's a village in Italy where they have changed the whole system, actually. They have come up with their own language. They've come up with their own way to do money. They do a lot of barters. They take children at 6 months old, and they start teaching them different things.
Yes. And I don't know anything about it, I'm afraid.
Okay, I can hardly hear you again. But anyway, it's in Italy. If you look on the internet, you can find them. It's Damanhur. Damahur. It could be D-E, I don't remember. But they have a whole different society that they have there in Italy. And it's very, very interesting how they have done it and how their own culture has made a difference with their children. Because like I said, they start teaching them at 6 months old. So how old, David, in your opinion, do you think children should start to really learn?
Well, it depends what you mean by learning. They're learning absolutely tremendously fast from the moment they're born.
I can hardly hear you.
I think it's a mistake to think that children need to be taught, because they just learn. They learn to talk, they learn to walk, they learn to move, they learn all sorts of things very, very fast. They learn more in their first couple of years than they do in any other time of their lives. And I think for adults to get involved in trying to tell them what to do is probably a mistake. It's interfering with the natural development that will take place if they are left to develop for themselves. And I think 6 months, I think lessons are a mistake.
You think
it's? I heard someone the other day saying, "I've always wanted to learn. I just can't bear being taught." And I think you don't want to teach little children because they're learning so fast anyway.
You know, I agree with you. I think it's very important that children get to learn, but get to learn in a more fun way, not one where they're trying to fit everybody into a round hole if they're a square peg, you know, stuff like that. I also think it's real important that the adults actually start to step aside a little bit and start talking with the children and ask them what it is that they are really interested in without telling them, oh, because I'm an attorney, that's what you're going to be, or because I'm a doctor, that's what you're going to be. Because that goes on a lot, and I don't think it's fair, because there are many, many children who really do not want to follow, quote, their parents' footsteps, and yet they're almost being made to think that that's the only thing they can do. Do you think if parents just backed off, David, and allowed children to be who they are and learn what they want at their pace, it would make a big difference with what's going on in the world today?
I think children have often much more understanding of the things that go wrong in the world than adults do, because once you've grown up, you accept a whole lot of things that you shouldn't really accept. I mean, you accept wars, which is totally unbelievable, that people just accept that wars happen. They see wars happen, and they, instead of objecting, they just accept it. And children understand things like that. They understand things like cruelty. They understand a whole lot of the things that adults have learned to accept because they feel they can't do anything about them. Children are still aware of them, still feel they must be put right.
With the school that I'm doing, David, we actually, after we get the school built and running, we have children there, we're actually going to also have classes for parents to not teach them, but help them to understand how a lot of them are more of a hindrance than to benefit their children, so that they really know how to relate to the children and they know how to listen, because most parents today really don't listen, I don't think. And so that's going to be part of the teaching for the school of now, is that the parents will also not be told that they have to come, but it will be offered that they can come for free, and that way they can help understand why these children really need to be who they are versus who everybody's trying to make them be. Do you think that would be beneficial to parents?
Yes, I think probably it would. I saw an extreme example. It's the pastor in Ecuador isn't there anymore because the founder's got too old, I think, so that's not the reason they gave for stopping it. But when they insisted on parents coming for the parent training, and I thought they were doing it. And they said if parents arranged, for instance, for a child to have music lessons outside the school, without consulting the school, they said they had to take the child away. They wouldn't allow the parents to do anything without the approval of the school, and I thought that was going too far.
I think if they insist that the parents come, they're going to probably rebel because they don't like being told what to do either. But
yes, exactly.
I do think it's important that parents get to be part of what the child's education is about and what they really like and what they enjoy so that they can encourage them with that. You know, I'm in New Mexico, and New Mexico is very low ranking as far as children graduating. And so there has to be a different way to make these children, not make them, but have them want to really graduate, have them want to get their education, however means they can, in a very good setting that could actually be a very happy setting. Because all day long, all I hear from kids is, I don't want to go to school. It's so boring. It's so this. It's so that. And so I ask them, what do you think needs to be done for the school? And they've talked mostly about everything we talked about today, David, is what these children have said, you know, would make them really want to go to school. And so I think it's important that people understand that the system truly needs to be changed. We cannot stay with the old ways and expect these new children to enjoy it because they're just not going to do it. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's true, yes. I think it's, I think it would be, it's really important that things should change. People we get so stuck in their way, it's very, very difficult to actually get anything changed.
Our time is almost up, David. Have we covered everything that you wanted to talk about?
I just wanted to say about one of the things that happens in Britain is that there are schools in the government system which are run online that I would thoroughly approve of. One of the best schools I've ever seen is one of them, the Secondary School for Children.
I can't hear you. Could you repeat that statement a little bit louder?
Talk a bit louder, did you say? Sorry, we lost each other, have we?
No, I'm still here. I couldn't hear you because you're probably have the phone now too far away from your mouth. So,
I've seen these schools in this country that are really run online by the approval, and they get either closed down or a new head is appointed to change them back into the more traditional type of school. And that's the reason why I've, in fact, always taught in private schools where parents have to pay. It's not because I approve of parents having to pay. It's because if you do it within the state system, it gets stopped over and over again.
David, do you think some children who live away from home and live in a school, like a live-in school, sometimes are better off than being at home every day after school and seeing what goes on at home? Do you think that would be, a good statement?
I think it's a good thing that they should go home after school. Ideally it depends on the home, I suppose. I mean, there are homes where it would be better if the children never went there at all, but a family life is very important, I think.
Because, see, the school of now is a live-in school and a day school both when it's finished. And it's actually going to accommodate 500 students, K through high school. And the teaching is all going to be different, like what we've been talking about. Children are going to have a lot of say in what's going on. They're going to be...
I can't hear you very well at the moment.
I said the school of now, the one I'm doing. When I'm finished with it, when it's finished, will accommodate 500 students, K through high school, and it is a live-in school and a day school both. And I think...
Yes, I think I like that idea, yes.
That kind of balance is good. And it's not based upon grades or age. It's based upon each individual child, who that child is and at what level they're at, and then actually put into compatible classrooms with other children like them, and there will be no more than 15 students per class. Because I also think that part of the education system is that the teachers are so bogged down with 30, 35, and 40 students in a class that they can't possibly teach. So all the things that I seem to think would be wrong with normal education are the things that will be changed at the school of now. And I think it will work. And I think it will be a really good model. And I think people will understand how individual the children really are and how smart they really are just by being able to be who they are. And so that's one of the big goals for the school of now that I'm foreseeing.
Good. I hope it works well.
I'm going to try to make sure it works really well. David, it looks like our time is just about up. So give out your website again, please, and how they can get your books.
Yeah, right. My website is www.davidgribble, which is spelled David, DavidGribble, .co.uk. And the place to get my books from, you can get some of them through Arrow. Do you know Arrow, the Education Revolution I'm afraid I can't remember what their website is, but that's an American organization which has some of my books. Otherwise, you have to go through this other website, which is www.libed.org.uk.
And if they go to your website, again, there is a lot, and I do mean a lot, of information. Very helpful information I think parents really should take a look at. And because there's a lot on there, and we only covered a small portion of it. But I think the big thing that both you and I agree with, David, is that the system really needs to be changed at this point and allow these children to actually be who they are. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely. That sounds a very good thing, yes.
So do you travel, like if somebody wants to pay to have you come and see them to help them, you know, like say a school, to readjust it or realign it or rework it somehow, do you go and travel for that, or do you just do it mostly by phone?
No, I haven't done, I have traveled a lot. I'm not traveling anymore, just because I'm 79 now, nearly 79, and I don't like flying, and I don't travel much anymore, no. And what I did,
right.
I never went to help people with schools. I went to visit them and see what they did.
All right, David, it's been very, very nice talking to you. Thank you for taking the time, and we'll talk again, okay?
Not at all. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk later. Take care. Bye now.